This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Hi, I'm Jamie Busson. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss how your digestion changes as you age with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll find out about a type of enzyme that blocks the effectiveness of antibiotics with researcher Dr. Albert Berhuis. We'll learn about the health benefits of cooking with cannabis with chef Adam Vandermeer. And lastly, we'll discover why alpha males die early with author Dave Rossi. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Emergency rooms across the country are seeing more patients with severe stomach pain and long bouts of vomiting. And doctors say that many of these cases are linked to heavy long-term cannabis use. Until recently, there was no clear way for hospitals to record the condition. But that changed on October 1st when the World Health Organization added a new diagnostic code for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, or CHS. The new code is part of the International Classification of Diseases. It gives doctors a simple and accurate way to identify and track the syndrome, which begins within 24 hours of cannabis use and can last for days. People with CHS often experience these episodes several times a year. Researchers say that the update will greatly improve data on the condition. With a specific code, investigators can now spot trends and better understand why CHS is becoming more common. Many health workers are still learning about the syndrome, which can lead to repeated and expensive emergency visits before it's recognized. Treatment can also be challenging. Standard nausea medications often don't work well, and some patients struggle to accept that cannabis may be causing their symptoms. Hot showers and capsaicin cream sometimes offer temporary relief, but stopping cannabis use is a key to recovery. Question. What's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer. The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings, and he's a frequent guest on this show. Welcome back, Gordon. How are you doing?
Very good. Just getting on the getting off a tail end of a cold.
Well, get some rest, drink some liquids. Here I am telling you what to do. That's crazy. But we're not here to talk about colds today. We're actually here to talk about something very interesting, which we haven't covered specifically, and that is sort of gut health as we age. I don't know about you, but I've noticed, you know, I'll call it the gut microbiome. Like, mine is changing. It's ever in flux. And I can't eat the same way I used to, let's say, 20 years ago. I'm sure I'm not alone.
You join the club. I will say this. We're living organisms. We're not machines. And the nice thing about a machine is that you have a bench line, and you can tune up your machine to hit the bench line. But because we're living organisms, you know, as we age, everything changes, and the organism itself is influenced by so many different things, right?
Yeah.
If we're talking about the digestive process, the Process, I mean, it's dependent on many things. It depends on the diet that we eat. The diet that we eat also affects the makeup of the microbiome, right? If you eat more of a certain type of food, you get a different type of bacteria growing in your gut, right? So you have all those things. And then as we grow older, even though we don't like to admit it, we would like to be able to eat as much as we were when we were younger, but our body just cannot digest as well. And that could be because of not insufficient enzymes being produced, right? I know there's people who will think that sometimes the body doesn't produce enough acids, right? The acid in the stomach actually does affect the digestive process. Right, but I can go about that a little bit later on, right? But I know people look at that. The bottom line, though, is that as we grow older, we just have to listen to our bodies, right? Much as we would like to say, well, when we go to the buffet, you want to walk out and get your money's worth. Sometimes, as we get older, that is impossible. So I would say, if you're going to go to that, make sure you eat the stuff that you can't make at home.
Exactly. I'm with you. I mean, I've been noticing, I get bloating. I don't get it, but I know others, I speak with friends, they get irregular. Some of them have developed food sensitivities. I haven't yet, but I have a friend of mine who now all of a sudden, can't have gluten and has noticed that when he eats dairy, it's more problematic for him. Like, what's happening? Is it a change in the hormones? What's going on with that?
Your guess is as good as mine, and I will tell you this though, but that we don't know the exact cause, but we know some of the consequences of the exact of the cause, right? Meaning, when I say that, I mean when we get bloating, right? What causes the bloating? The bloating could be caused by A, the microbiome being different, right? It can be caused by B, we don't digest properly, so a lot of the undigested food goes down to the colon. And all the microbes down there saying, holy smokes, we're getting a buffet now, right? Because there's a lot of undigested food. So what happens? The bacteria in there just starts to eat and chew, and they put out their waste products. Their waste products, for some of these bacteria, will destroy other bacteria. It may encourage the growth of other type of bacteria. Some of the compounds produced by the microbiome, right, also when we absorb it back from the colon, so it affects our body systems, right? So it's an interplay. That's the word I'm trying to use, is an interplay, right? There are certain things that we can do to try to minimize, right? And I say try to minimize as opposed to cure or stop or prevent, right? Prevent is a very difficult word as we grow older. Some of the things I can suggest we do, digestive enzymes, right? And that's a big one that we do. When I was in my younger days, when I was in my 20s, did not need digestive enzymes. The body can handle everything I throw at it and then some, right? When I hit my 40s, digestive enzymes were a godsend, especially for people who eat at irregular hours. I know lots of people who will eat at 8, 9 o'clock and then go right to bed, and then they can't sleep because they feel bloated, et cetera, or the food just seems to be stuck, right? And you know what? If you take digestive enzymes, it does make a huge difference as far as comfort level goes.
How do you know if you should be taking a digestive enzyme? Is it the bloating? Is it the gas? Is
All of the above, right?
okay.
How do digestive enzymes work? Now, let me back up here. When we say digestive enzymes, you do know there's a whole variety of different digestive enzymes. For example, you have proteases, which will digest protein, and I'm using a broad class, okay? In the body, there's several different types of proteases that are naturally occurring in the body, right? But you take proteases, which will digest proteins. You should take cellulases, which will help break down some of the fiber in the body, right? And I'll explain that a little bit in a while. We also have amylases, which will break down carbohydrates, right? And we have lipases, which will break down fats, right? And then we also have lactase, which will help break down dairy, right? Now, I do know when a lot of people look for digestive enzymes, they look for proteases, right? But you know, if you were a carnivore or if you're on the carnivore diet, right, you should get an enzyme that's very high in protease. However, most of us, even if you're a carniv if you're on the carnivore diet, do eat carbohydrates. You just don't eat as much, but you still eat the carbohydrates. You need some of these enzymes to help break down these things. My suggestion is if you're going to get an enzyme product, get something that has all of the above enzymes that I just mentioned. And the reason for that is because we're omnivores. We eat everything under the sun, right? So we eat a mixture of all of these things, right? Now, most of the enzymes that we do get are not coming from an animal source. Most of the enzymes are coming from a fungal source or a bacterial source, right? And they're made by bacterial fermentation and it's purified, et cetera, right? There's a lot of technology in purification of enzymes. Okay. But enzymes, again, is not only used for digestion. Like, you know, your acid wash genes, they use enzymes in that process, right? Sometimes in baking bread, they will use enzymes in that process. So enzymes have many, many uses, not only for digestive purposes, right? So when we buy enzymes and we make an enzyme product, you have to choose the right type of enzymes. You got to make sure that the enzymes are active at 37 degrees, which is the body temperature. You got to make sure the enzymes are active at pHs, which you find not so much in the stomach, but in the small intestine. So you're looking at pHs 7, 8, 9, 9 on the outside, okay? But 7 and 8, definitely you need to have enzymes that are active there, right? Now, the reason these enzymes are important is because how they affect bloating. If you digest your food properly, there's less food, undigested food going on into the colon. If there's less undigested food going on into the colon, you're going to get less gas being produced because the bacteria don't have that much food coming down to them, right? So that is one of the ways it'll help with the bloating.
With the enzymes, Gordon, is this kind of like a preventative measure where you should be taking it regularly and daily, or is this the type of product that you would take when you have you're bloating, for example?
It depends on the individual. Like if you're one of those people that get bloating every time you eat, my suggestion, make sure you take your enzymes with your food. If you're one of those people who will go to the buffet, overindulge, and get bloating, take it then. If you're one of those people, most of the times if you watch what you eat, you're comfortable, right? You don't need to take the enzymes, right? So I would say the enzymes are useful for those type of things.
Forgive my ignorance. Is this a liquid, or does it come in a different sort of
Oh
form?
no, never take, if an enzyme is in a liquid form, it's useless, right? The shelf life is useless. It has to be in a pill form. And the thing about enzymes is that enzymes have to be when you're taking the food, right? It has to meet up with the food at some point, right?
Oh, I see. And you need it in pill form so it can make it through the digestive juices of your stomach and get into your colon, correct?
Yeah, that too. But one thing about enzymes tend to be more resistant to. Okay, let me back up here a second. All enzymes are made up of proteins. Every single one known to man and then some are made up of proteins. One thing you know about proteins is that if you put a protein in an acid, it deteriorates the enzyme, it deteriorates the protein, it breaks it up, it denatures it. However, what makes enzymes special is that they are more resistant to acid than your regular proteins, right? And it has to do with the type of amino acid makeup of the enzymes, right? And again, though, the enzymes that you use, you have to make sure that it survives passage through the stomach. And one of the ways of doing that is that you put it in a pill, right? And if the pill is in an acid-resistant capsule, right, it ensures that the enzymes disintegrate in the small intestine instead of the stomach. Now, I know people will say to me, they think that a lot of digestion occurs in the stomach. And I say to them, no. If you think about it, food probably sits 20 minutes, half an hour, maybe an hour in the stomach, tops. Okay? Now, during that time, the only thing that's digested in the stomach is really the proteins, right? And a lot of the proteins are only partially digested in the stomach. The reason you want the stomach, though, the stomach with the acids that they produce in the stomach, one of the things that the acid do, it denatures the proteins, it denatures the carbohydrates, it denatures a lot of the things, so that when it gets into the small intestine, right, the enzymes in the small intestine can then get access to all of the bonds, the chemical bonds in the food, and can break them up, so you can actually absorb amino acids, you can absorb the sugars, right? Because the carbohydrates are broken down into sugars, right? And by sugars, I mean, glucose, right? Most of the carbohydrates are absorbed as glucose. Carbohydrates are not absorbed as carbohydrates. Now, and also the nice thing about the acids is that the acid also prevents a lot of bad bacteria from getting access to the lower small intestine, because the acid environment kills off a lot of the bacteria. Yes, you will have some getting through, because if none ever get through, you'll never have a functioning microbiome, right? But so bacteria do get through, right? I didn't talk a lot. I should digress a little bit and talk a little bit about the microbiome, because that's also very important, right? If you have the right type of bacteria in the gut, you can get less bloating, or you can get not even only less bloating, you get less irregularity also. Right, because the bacteria make compounds which affect the motility in the colon. All right, so but that might be another story for another day.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You are more than welcome. We'll talk again.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic.
Canadians, we are tough. We shovel before work even begins. We fall, we get up. It's part of the game. We plunge without realizing it's even polar. And even the ones who aren't as tough as they used to be are still tough. Let's stay tough, Canada. We don't have time for COVID. Visit spikevax.ca to book your COVID vaccine appointment today. Spikevax is used to prevent COVID-19 disease caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Like all vaccines, 100% protection cannot be guaranteed and adverse reactions may occur. Talk to your healthcare professional to see if Spikevax is right for you.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Albert Burhaus is a distinguished James McGill professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Microbiology and Immunology at McGill University. He's also the associate director of the McGill Antimicrobial Resistance Center. His research focuses on three-dimensional structural elucidation of protein-drug interactions, particularly bacterial proteins that confer antibiotic resistance. His research informs the development of next-generation anti-infectives to overcome antibiotic resistance and the design of adjuvants that enhance the effectiveness of antibiotic therapies. Dr. Berhaus has served on the editorial boards of several journals, consulted for the biotech and pharmaceutical industry, participated in and chaired expert panels advising granting agencies, and has been a member of various advisory boards. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
I'm doing very good. Thank you for this very lengthy introduction. I feel embarrassed almost, or not almost, I feel embarrassed.
No, you shouldn't be. We're just setting you up so that whatever you say next, everybody's going to believe immediately.
Okay.
So your work deals with sort of a big topic, which is antibiotic resistance. Why are bacteria which are antibiotic resistant so problematic?
So you have to realize we're using antibiotics almost, in all over in medicine. You cannot get an operation without getting antibiotics afterwards. all we do in medicine requires antibiotics. Suppose we cannot use them anymore. That will really make our life a lot harder. Operations will be suddenly very dangerous. Just think back to the 1910 or 1920s. Not that any of us lived in those days, but people died all the time of infections. So we don't want to go back to that time, and that's the situation we could be facing because of antibiotic resistance.
Because these bacteria are mutating and learning how to overcome the antibiotics that they're being exposed to, correct?
Yes and no.
Okay.
What we actually have been doing, antibiotics have been around. You would think, you know, the first antibiotics came on the market in the 1940s and the 1950s. But actually, antibiotics have been around for way, way longer, probably a billion years.
Hmm.
These are molecules that other bacteria make to sort of use for their own little warfare to get more ground and to overcome, you know, other bacteria. What happened is that we discovered these compounds, these antibiotics, and now use them in the clinic. But just like with any warfare, if you have a weapon, there is also a trick to fight against it. And so bacteria have found various ways to fight against it. Not all bacteria have those. Some do, some don't. The ones that do, we call resistance. Now, of course, if you start using these drugs, you get rid of the ones that don't have the resistance, and you're left with all the ones that are resistant. And that's what we're facing. We're selecting for resistant bacteria. And the more we do that, the more this becomes a problem.
Oh, that's interesting. There are biomechanical ways that the bacteria actually become resistant. Can you explain, you know, briefly some of the ways in which bacteria have this resistance? Like, what are the mechanisms?
So one of the little tricks that bacteria can do that we cannot do is they can grab pieces of information called DNA from other bacteria. And so quite, you know, once in a while they grab a piece of DNA that tells you how to make a resistance mechanism. Those resistance mechanisms can be like, make my cell wall, my little wall, a bigger wall. Make a thicker wall around me. Sometimes they also use tricks of make an enzyme that if you see in antibiotics, let's chew up this enzyme. Or chew up this antibiotic. And that's actually the ones that my lab has been studying, these enzymes that cause resistance.
So the enzymes, so what are they effectively doing? They're breaking down the components that are trying to do the job, or is it more of a delivery issue?
It's mostly you take an antibiotic and you chemically change it. That can either be that you chop it up, or you add a bigger bulk to it, but whatever change you make, the antibiotic is different, and it's actually no longer an antibiotic. You have to realize an antibiotic is just a chemical that goes into a bacteria and then sits in a place that causes problems. Think of it, your body or your cell is a giant machine with all kinds of gears, and you start adding sand to it, and suddenly all the gears stop working. That's what an antibiotic does inside a bacteria. What this enzyme would do is maybe chew up these sand blocks to much smaller parts so that they don't cause any problems anymore. And the bacteria lives happily ever after. But of course, you remain being infected and suffer a severe infection.
So, yeah, what you're saying is that it works in both ways. It renders the antibiotic ineffectual because it materially changes the antibiotic nature, but also it can prevent the delivery by making it, you know, perhaps not be able to permeate or something along those lines.
Yes, mostly the first way though.
Got it. Okay. So I understand you've done some, you know, really important research that has just been recently reported in that you found two enzymes that block antibiotics from doing their job, but they do so in a new way. How did you do that? And how do these enzymes block the antibiotic?
Okay, so we did this by studying how these enzymes interact with the antibiotic and how they chemically change the antibiotic. And we have done that for a whole number of enzymes. And what we have seen in the past for whenever we look at an enzyme, how it does that, these enzymes are incredibly clever, even though this is the result of evolution. They actually mimic the real target. So go back again. These antibiotics are a billion years old. They have their own evolution, and they have evolved to bind to a crucial machine inside the bacteria. And their shape is optimized to block that machine perfectly. Now, if you want to catch that antibiotic, you probably want to pretend like, hey, I am the important machine. Please interact with me. And as soon as the antibiotic does that, it gets chemically modified.
So it's a decoy.
It's a complete decoy. Exactly. It's a decoy. And so that's what we have seen over and over and over again, until we looked at these two enzymes, and they don't use the decoy mechanism.
Ah.
And we go like, wow, and you still are effective. And lo and behold, one is not so effective, but the other one is just as effective. It's maybe the analogy I was thinking of, like we have been thinking about heists, breaking into a museum and getting a beautiful artwork. And we all are imagining this is by a cat burglar that goes through the roof at night and things like that. And we are expecting, even insurance companies expect that that's how a robbery would occur.
Right.
Until a few weeks ago in Paris, we suddenly see something completely different.
Right. I thought that's where you were going with this analogy. Okay, good.
Right?
Yeah.
Completely different. And it still worked. That also shows you, what do you do next?
Well, insurance companies
are indeed going like, oops.
Right.
We have to think not just about the cat burglar, but we have to come up with other things to protect against that. Right. And this is sort of the situation that antibiotic discovery is now in. And basically we realize the problem is bigger than we thought.
So basically what you've done is you've identified sort of another potential breach point in the system, right? And now, as difficult as things were in developing new antibiotics, now you have to worry about another potential problem with the effectiveness of the antibiotic. So now that we know about this potential sort of problem, what should we be doing next?
So it's not an easy thing to solve. The problem has just become bigger in that there is multiple ways in which bacteria become or can be resistant. And finding a new way to make a new antibiotic that is not impacted by all of these tricks that bacteria have up their sleeve, it's just now become a harder problem. I'm very optimistic in to say that it's not an impossible problem. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in this kind of research if I thought, oh, give up, guys. We there's no way we'll ever solve this problem. But the problem hasn't become easier since we've discovered this.
Is your lab going to be sort of ideating possible new ways of developing antibiotics, or is that for another lab to do?
That is for my lab to do, but we have told the world about it, and we hope other and we know other people will also be looking at this problem. This is the good part of a problem like antibiotic resistance. We need a lot of people working on this with new ideas and new ways of solving this very complex problem, and so I will be working on it, but I am confident that lots of more people will be working on this as well.
Do we have enough time to get this right? Because my understanding is first you have to come up with a plausible solution, then you have to test it in labs such as yours, and then you have to create a product. But even then, that takes years in order to make it marketable. I know we can make drugs a lot faster than we used to be able to with AI and CRISPR and all sorts of other tools, but do you think we have enough time to get this right before it becomes more problematic?
Yeah, that's like I said, I am optimistic. But you know, to put some pressure on here,
yeah,
right? If we don't do anything, you know, various people have sort of make prognosis. Like, if in the next 25 years we're still in the same situation as today, we're actually in a worse situation because more bacteria will be resistant. And the prediction is that in the meantime, about 40 million people will have died because of this.
Oh my gosh.
40 million is a big number, but that's literally everyone in Canada.
Yeah.
Canada has a population of 40 million. If we wait 25 years, the population of, you know, the number of people like the population of Canada will have died of this problem. So I hope more people will work on this, more companies will work on this, because it's something we need to solve. It's, you know, it's not an option.
No, I hear you. So I'm hoping anybody who's listening who has any kind of sway on funding, and you know, we're not a scientific journal here. We're a consumer show. But if anybody's interested, we should try and make sure that labs like the one that this gentleman works in get proper funding. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was a lot of fun chatting with you. Thank you for chatting with me. Yeah.
That was Dr. Albert Berhuis. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss cooking with cannabis on The Tonic.
Canadians, we are tough. We shovel before work even begins. We fall. We get up. It's part of the game. We plunge without realizing it's even polar. And even the ones who aren't as tough as they used to be are still tough. Let's stay tough, Canada. We don't have time for COVID. Talk to your healthcare professional to see if Spikevax is right for you. Spikevax is used to prevent COVID-19 disease caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Like all vaccines, 100% protection cannot be guaranteed and adverse reactions may occur. Find additional product information at spikevax.ca.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Your Canna Chef is led by husband and wife team Adam and Jeanette Vandermeer, who share a passion for food, wellness, and helping adults explore cannabis safely and intentionally. Chef Adam brings over 30 years of culinary experience to their microdosed, wellness-focused approach to infused cuisine, while Jeanette shapes the mindful framework that guides their classes, private dining experiences, and infusion workshops. Together, they are developing their first cookbook designed to bring approachable, confidence-building cannabis cooking to everyday homes. With us today is Chef Adam. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thanks for having me, Jamie.
So, you know, off the top, I got to ask the obvious question. Other than getting high, why would somebody want to cook with cannabis? Are there actual health benefits?
I love this question, and I'm going to preface the entire thing with, I am not a doctor. I'm a cannabis chef, and I don't think that in the history of mankind, anybody has had a medical issue or a medical incident where their first thought was, I should probably talk to a chef about this. I do not diagnose anything whatsoever, but I do work with a lot of people who use this plant very intentionally. And I myself am a medical user, but for most people, cooking with cannabis actually isn't about getting high. It's about a better quality of life, whether that's better sleep, less stress, easing anxiety, managing inflammation, the list goes on and on. But when you cook with cannabis instead of smoking it, there's obviously no combustion.
Right.
And you're not inhaling. So when you use it as a culinary tool, you're not dependent on the refined sugars and additives found in a lot of store-bought edibles. You're getting a cleaner, healthier experience, and you're actually getting your cannabinoids through real food. And honestly, I think that's why a lot of people bring us into their homes for private classes or dining experiences. It really is the most comfortable way to explore cannabis intentionally through real food and real cooking.
Okay, so, you know, for the uninitiated, they might be imagining, you know, you take some weed and you just crumble it up or some hash into some brownies. I mean, that's the old school.
I'm giving my age away,
but that's not actually it. My understanding is you first have to sort of create a compound or a liquid first. Am I right about that, or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely correct. And I think the way to look at it is cooking with cannabis isn't like tossing oregano into
right.
a pot.
Yeah.
You have to, there's a process. You have to do a process of what's called decarbing. And basically that's just gently heating the cannabis and making the THC accessible. And then we need to infuse it into a fat, whether that's, butter or ghee or coconut oil, olive oil, essentially any fat. And once it's infused, then you can measure it. And that's where sort of safe and predictable cooking starts. And when Jeanette and I were designing our teaching classes, we wanted to make sure that it was very, very simple, step by step. And we've now designed a virtual infusion program so people can learn this literally from anywhere.
Okay, so I'm off smoking or vaping for a long time now, and I only use edibles. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about it is, you can manage your dosing, right? Because if you're a certain age, you can decide that you want to, have a certain amount or more or less or whatever. But I'm curious as to how somebody who, may not have a ton of experience can actually manage the dosing while they're cooking. Can you kind of walk us through that?
Absolutely. And I think those of us in the edible space we've all had that mystery edible.
Yeah.
The one where your buddy makes a brownie and says, here, have this.
Yeah.
And you ask what is in there, and he has absolutely no idea.
And you can't get off the floor 3 hours later.
That's right. And so I'm not that has no place in my life. This is intentional usage. So I use an incredibly simple ratio. I use 3.5 grams of cannabis flower to 1 cup of fat. That'll keep our infusions to around 20 milligrams of THC per tablespoon. And so with that, and now we have the technology to test mm-hmm. everything. So any of the infusions that we create, we test, and we know that our methods and the math is reliable. Now, once you know that, once you have the comfort of knowing that tablespoon of butter has 20 milligrams of THC in it, then you can confidently make whatever you're making.
And I presume through the cooking process, I mean, this may be a stupid question, but like it evenly disperses through whatever you're making, whether you're baking or cooking or adding it in as, I don't know how, but like it is evenly distributed so that it isn't sort of in one brownie, but not in another, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah. And that's actually some of the things that we really focus on. One of the biggest mistakes I see, new people to cannabis cooking do is actually cook with the cannabis.
Right.
Whether you're, sauteing vegetables in infused oil.
Right.
I have no idea. Like, I can't control that.
Right.
So I don't know what's left in the pan. So what we do is we use cannabis infusions as finishers.
Got it. So, okay.
So in that brownie, I wouldn't actually infuse the brownie. I would infuse the icing drizzle I did over top.
Got it.
Or what have you.
Okay. So I don't really care one way or another, but a lot of people don't actually enjoy the taste of cannabis. Do you mitigate against that, or is it just like, it's a strong taste? Do you do anything about that or not?
Absolutely. I don't like the taste of cannabis in most of my dishes. There are a few times where I'm like, hey, I wouldn't mind a little hint of that. But because of our process, because of the low dosing that we do, and the fact that we we again add the infusion as the finishing ingredient. If we don't want cannabis flavor, it just won't be there. We can make sure that either we're flavor profiling it with things that will mask it, or because our dose is so low, 90% of the time you can't taste it. And our cookbook is actually built on that idea. We're hoping to have it ready in January. And basically we reached out to our network of friends and said, what do you cook on a Wednesday night?
Yeah.
And because I have to be honest, I don't know what normal people cook on a Wednesday night. I've been a chef for 30 years. It's probably very different than what I make. And so our goal with that is to make weeknight meals that can be infused, don't have to be infused. So if you're making something for the whole family and only one person wanted it to be infused, they infuse it and the rest of it doesn't have to be. And if I'm completely honest, my goal is to have Naomi reviewing my cookbook next holiday season.
Okay. Well, we'll get on that. That will be interesting because I'm the guinea pig. So,
awesome.
But I'm thinking you add a new meaning to Taco Tuesday, right? I guess the salsa just, you know, becomes something else.
And all you do with that is you, instead of using regular olive oil in your salsa, you use your infused.
Interesting. What about the CBD? Are you dosing for CBD as well, or does it disperse in the same way that the THC does?
It does. In our private dinings, we actually counterbalance a lot of our THC with CBD. Mm-hmm. It isn't something that we necessarily teach, but the process is the same. So if you're looking to extract CBD from flower, all you need is straight hemp flower and something that has zero THC content, and you can get your CBD that way as well.
Are there special tools that you have that allow you to do the extractions and build these oils, or does everybody kind of have this in their kitchen and they can do it?
To answer the question, yes, I have special tools, but I also do this professionally.
Right.
But for the average person, they need a mason jar, a baking sheet, and a saucepan. That's pretty much it. There's a ton of gadgets out there, but that do make your life easier. And there's testing equipment that you can use. But I'm a big believer in keeping it really simple. So if you can cook a Wednesday night dinner, you can cook with cannabis.
And what about preserving the food? You know, sometimes some foods stay longer, better, depending on, you know, you're a chef, you know, some things last, some things don't. Can mm-hmm. can you freeze something that's cannabis infused, or how do you keep it? Do you keep it on the shelf? Like, what's the shelf life?
You treat it exactly like any other food. Cannabis doesn't magically preserve anything at all. So butter goes in the fridge. Or the freezer, and for sure you can. I freeze my can of butter all the time. Sauces go in the fridge. For us, the big rule is labeling.
Of course, yeah.
Making sure everything is clearly marked and stored safely. You know, you don't want to surprise anybody.
Is there such a thing as cannabis etiquette? Like, if you're making cannabis infused foods, like how do you deal with people other than you know, your immediate family or friends when you're doing this kind of thing?
My biggest etiquette is I don't do dips. I do not do shareables. That is again, I lose complete control.
Yeah.
And so we don't pass hors d'oeuvres. Everything is individualized. When we do our private dinings, if you knew your number was 10 milligrams, we could spread that across four courses, and the person next to you could decide that their goal is 2.5 milligrams across those four courses, and we can do that. So people, you know, knowing their comfort levels. The other big thing is to be really mindful with alcohol.
Yep.
They don't necessarily mix all that well. That's kind of a really experienced move to
I can tell you from firsthand experience. I call it the bomb, And it's, how shall I say this? There's not a lot of functioning that occurs if you do both.
No. And it's a great way to push a green out. Hospitality is all about trust.
Whether
I'm cooking infused or whether I'm not, you need to be able to trust the food that's in front of you. So our goal is to make everybody feel safe and completely in control of their experience.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and explaining all of that.
Well, the pleasure is all mine.
That was Chef Adam Vandermeer. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll learn why alpha males die early on The Tonic. Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dave Rossi is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, CEO of CQ Construction, and author of The Imperative Habit and Alphas Die Early. After decades of high-performance living and building multimillion-dollar companies, he faced the ultimate burnout, losing everything he thought defined him. That collapse became his awakening, and today he teaches the Omega Man mindset, a conscious model of success rooted in mindfulness, emotional mastery, and authentic leadership. His work helps men evolve beyond ego-driven ambition to create sustainable purpose, balance, and inner freedom. And to learn more about him, you can go to DaveRossiGlobal.com. Welcome to the show, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. Jamie, thank you so much for having me.
So your latest book is titled Alphas Die Early, very dramatic, which is a bold claim. What convinced you that traditional, quote unquote, alpha male behavior isn't just emotionally harmful, but physically dangerous to men's long-term health?
Well, I guess to begin with, I don't know if you look at the data and follow the research that it is actually a bold claim. If emulating an alpha was successful, then why are the trends going so starkly downward for men today? In fact, I don't think we have a gun problem. I think we have a man problem. Most of the killings and the domestic terrorist attacks are men with guns, and mostly young men. And you know, suicide rates are up for men. Drug addiction is up for men. Body dysmorphia is up for men. Higher education is down for men. And so in general, the trends show that whatever archetype that people are trying to emulate isn't working. And for me, you know, my research has shown that it isn't actually the behaviors of an alpha that are harmful, but it's the attempt to try to be an alpha, that false facade that we put on is really what I find damaging physically and mentally. And it turns into this endless loop. For a man trying to be a man, trying to survive like Darwin explained, the survival of the fittest, the 800-pound gorilla. What is that 800-pound gorilla today? Never more than ever has been more confusing for men. So they flip one TikTok and masculinity is one thing, and they flip it again into something else. And so in their efforts to try to be the survival of the fittest, they don't know what that is. And so what happens is they try and they fail because it changes, and they try and they fail because it changes. And this pattern of trying to be something they're not is what I find to be the dangerous product of the search for the alpha male.
Do you find that the economic stratification of our society is feeding into that? In other words, it's the undereducated males, the ones who have dead ends, who are failing to sort of function at the alpha level they may see and try and emulate. Is there anything to that, do you think?
I think, of course. I mean, this is mental health, right? I mean, yeah. When the mind goes, the body follows. And everyone on TikTok or Instagram or whatever social platform you look at is wealthy.
Yeah, of course.
And you look at these things and you think, wow, maybe I'm not that person. And instantly you're saying, I'm not surviving like an 800-pound gorilla. My instinctual drive, my DNA is pushing me to be something, to make myself comparable to the man next to me. it's the peacock theory. You know, it's their feathers are brighter than mine. For Homo sapiens, we have the opportunity to try to manufacture feathers and to be brighter. And I think it's that burnout, that effort to be something and then to fail becomes this endless loop. And of course, the economics and money is a huge part of it. That is a giant factor of survivability in the world. Money equals survival. More money equals more survival. A lot of money equals 800-pound gorilla. So that's probably the most obvious thing, you know, that I think young men see is that. And when you don't measure up, and you contextualize what you're seeing, it becomes very damaging and also a motivator to try to be something you're not.
Well, I think what you're describing is the motivation like that drives the incel community, right? Like, you know, I can't do this. I can't be that person. Therefore, I'm not successful. Therefore, like a pox on everybody. I'm just going to take everybody down and everybody's my enemy. What do you think are the most damaging behaviors of the alpha mindset?
Well, again, I think the most damaging behavior is just to pretend to be something you're not initially, because then you're never yourself. And, you know, one thing about, you know, longevity studies and certainly the blue zone studies will tell you that the number one trait of all blue zones, the number one trait is belonging and community.
Yep.
And so that sense of connectedness provides a lot of health benefits physically. It starts as an emotional and mental component, and it translates and manifests into a physical component. So the opposite of connection and community is obviously not connection. How strong of a connection do you think people can have when they're pretending to be somebody they're not? And so it isn't so much the outward behaviors are the symptom, right? It's kind of like the bleeding arm, but what's making you bleed is the cut. And a lot of people are focusing on the Band-Aid and the blood, but they're not focusing on what caused the cut to begin with. And so the actual behaviors are damaging in the sense that they're going backwards. It's off-putting to women. It's off-putting to other men. It's off-putting in business. To be and have bravado and be performance-driven is somewhat distracting and somewhat of a bully tactic. And those physical behaviors, those outward behaviors that you think you're trying to emulate, like the Andrew Tate kind of model, really don't work. They work with the dog pound cheering you on. But in terms of relationships, whether they're, you know, intimate relationships or relationships with coworkers and longevity studies with the community, those behaviors are really damaging and don't propel your life forward in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I guess what I would say in response to that is, and we've discussed the blue zones a lot on the show, is, you know, they are very unique and very small. And I'm not sure they translate necessarily to modern way of living. Like, I think the bigger problem, which is another one of my pet peeves, is social media and the internet and how it sort of projects all these images, you know, 10 times over and creates this sort of false narrative. To your earlier point, you know, everybody's rich on the web, you know, and everybody's rich on Instagram. I think that's true in the way that you mean it, in that it's not real. So I wonder how we get to these real communities and ways of
living. I don't think it has to be geography. I mean, the blue zones are small, you're right, but they're also relatively isolated.
Yeah.
But I live in Silicon Valley and I've put a practice into place to create my own blue zone within myself.
Okay.
For a lot of people, searching external validation, which is what everybody does, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because everybody does it, it's okay if you do it. And so if you're searching external validation, just go to an NFL football game on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Everybody's there trying to create community, but really they're looking for something to have happiness and joy. I never understood why you have to be in your happiest place, a football game, and then drink yourself to death to find more happiness when it's the opposite, right? I mean, it's so funny. I'm having such a great time at a football game. Let's drink and make it better, right? I mean, so you don't, when you search for external happiness, emotionally and mentally, it has an endpoint. Oh, the game's over. Okay, now what? Now I'm sad. Let's go find the next external form of happiness. So when you begin to stop chasing external things or performative things or validation things, I'm going to chase and get validated and have some kind of false presentation or curation of myself, validation. When you stop chasing that, you kind of create your own emotional and mental blue zone within yourself. And that's ultimately kind of the path of the Omega Man, is to try to create that inner sanctuary for yourself.
You're countering like decades of mythology, right? Like you know, it's been built from generation to generation. The Marlborough Man, particularly in the United States, we're up in Canada, but your notion of the Wild West and cowboys and you know what it means to be a man, which you know, obviously changes through time, but it also gets reinforced, doesn't it? And when you're talking about going to like you know tailgating at a football game. And then, you know, you're talking about a dopamine high, aren't you? And you know, somebody who's going to enjoy that is going to be extroverted, I would think.
Well, you're right in a way that I am going against decades of conditioning of what the definition of masculinity is. And my research has shown me that for 700 years, masculinity meant man.
Yeah.
This meant the anatomical traits of the man.
Right.
And it wasn't until World War II ended is that we started having this programming of John Wayne and I'm going to provide for you men coming home from war to rebuild the nuclear family. And that meant provide and buy a house and have a good job. And then it morphed and changed again. And it keeps changing decade to decade. And now it changes screen swipe to screen swipe. Every 7 seconds, there's a new definition of masculinity. And I'm not really changing the trend. What I'm proposing are things that have been around for thousands of years. I'm going back the way it was.
Okay, so let's do that then. What is the Omega Man? Like, what are you espousing?
Odysseus.
Okay.
There's no higher. You know, Joseph Campbell is someone who I've studied a lot, and I love Joseph Campbell. If you know who he is, The Hero's Journey, Man with a Thousand Faces, mm-hmm. and Odysseus exemplifies the hero's journey more than anyone that he went up. He was a history teacher, and he basically made these claims that throughout history, throughout cultures, throughout centuries, there are stories, mythology, and they're all the same. All of these stories, from ancient China to ancient Greece, to ancient Sumeria to Native American history, the stories are the same of the hero's journey. There's a fall from grace, there's a struggle, there's a battle, and then there's a return. Now, Odysseus is the penultimate example in his eyes and mine as well. Somebody who gave away fame, gave away money, and all he wanted to do was get back to the basics. His pursuit was to get back to humility, to get back to his home, to get back to his wife, not right. to have glory and riches and kingdoms afar, but to go back to the basics. And for someone like him, also the Omega Man is about not being reactive, not being emotive, not being a slave to the Darwinian pushes that say, perform, perform. You got to do this. You can do this. Don't look weak. You got to stand up for this person. You know, Odysseus didn't do that. When he returned, he slowly observed the world. He didn't react to the emotion of what happened to his kingdom. He slowly watched it and planned a response. Now, whenever you can suspend biology, whether it be food or emotional regularity, you know, a lot of cheating for men is about an emotional and biological push to serve some kind of trauma wound or some kind of past programming or some kind of validation. All of these biological pushes prevent the ability to grow and be strong and have self-mastery. The Megapath is about self-mastery. So I'm going back to the old days. I mean, what's happened in the last 100 years has been the anomaly.
Did you pick Odysseus because of the new Nolan movie coming out?
I did not. I love Odysseus, and I've seen every version of his movies. I think it's just a great story. It's a great character. I love mythology. I was kind of a Dungeons and Dragons guy when I was a kid.
Okay, I hear
and
you.
Just studying, yeah. And so, you know, I think it's apropos that this movie's coming out.
Yeah, I do too.
Because it does tackle this. I don't know that people are connecting masculinity with Odysseus, but they really should, because he goes through trials and he goes through you know, opportunities to choose poorly or to choose humility and grace and groundedness.
Look at the actor they chose, Matt Damon, to play Odysseus. He is, you know, he is the modern man. He's humble. Like, I think he espouses a lot of the values in real life that I think you're getting at. I have one last quick question for you. You know, in choosing the phrase Omega Man, Omega is the last letter. Are you suggesting this is our last chance to get things right? Why did you choose Omega?
Well, I want to show the transition of the hero's journey in a different way, from alpha to omega, right? It's the evolutionary tale from start to finish. And the finish isn't the last, it's our last mask. The reason why I picked omega was no more archetypes, no more pretending to be somebody else. You don't have to be an omega or a sigma. I mean, you don't have to be an alpha or a sigma or a beta. There's no more archetype. Omega is no mask. It's the end of putting on a facade.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Jamie, thank you so much. I had a great time.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, Dr. Albert Berhuis, Adam Vandermeer, and Dave Rossi. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contest prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.